Well, thank you very much for inviting me along this evening. It is a huge topic. Where do we go after COP26? And I shall, in 10 minutes, try to set out some framework to that question. So I think the starting point of any discussion of what we do next is a clear understanding of the facts about where we are and a brutal realism about what has and has not been achieved. So if we look at the baseline where we are today, we are adding 2 parts per million per annum to the concentration of carbon in the atmosphere. We have done that for the last 30 years without exception. 26 COPs, the 25 before in Glasgow, have so far made not a dent in that 2 parts per million. And it is very, very salutary to note that last year, despite all the lockdowns from coronavirus concerns, and despite the steep fall in emissions, we added another 2 parts per million to the concentration of carbon in the atmosphere. And where we go from now must focus on the problem. And the problem is the concentration of carbon in the atmosphere, not territorial carbon emissions, although they're part of it. And the problem is both sequestration and how our natural world absorbs carbon and emissions, not just emissions. So here we are, 26 COPs later, and we've had the same speeches. I have the quotes from used at each of the COPs in the past, and they're always the same about the turning point of history. We're saving the world. This is the crunch point. It's a great moment. We've made great decisions. And the reality is that it's almost always the same. And here we are this time. So we have a series of NDCs, which are not legally binding. And these NDCs have never been fully met in the past, but just supposing they're met in the future, as long as the sequestration side of the equation doesn't, quote, misbehave, then we will get to over two degrees warming at least. And some people suggest more. But of course, the lesson from last year is, even if you have radical cuts in emissions, you have to take into account all the stuff that's going on in the soils, in the natural environment, on the sequestration side, or what should be the sequestration side, to get the actual concentration effects in the atmosphere. A scary fact is that the Amazon is now a net emitter of carbon. So what did COP achieve? Well, apart from those NDCs, which don't fully add up, there were a series of other component parts. But just on the NDCs, climate change isn't going to be solved in England or London. It's going to be primarily solved in places like China, India, and sub-Saharan Africa. China does not intend to commit to stopping increasing its emissions of carbon until 2030, for another decade. It's already 30% of global emissions, or almost 30%. And it's going to take another 30 years after that to get to something it calls carbon neutrality. India is going to take half a century to get to net zero. That's, you know, thinking back to, Second World War to the end of the 20th century. Huge time span, and with no clear plan of how to get there. And in sub-Saharan Africa, it's not clear what the NDCs really mean, but this really matters. Nigeria might have a population bigger than Europe by the end of this century. What's going on there, the growth rates and what's being stripped out of the soils and the natural sequestration capacity is awesome in the scary sense of the word. So if you think that this sort of process and another 26 COPs are going to get us to a place to go to in the future where we're going to decarbonize and stop global warming, I say you need to explain why one more heave of a process that hasn't worked for 30 years is going to work going forward. There are two or three other bits of COP. There's the great funding. Rightly, we in the West should pay to help developing countries decarbonize, because a lot of the stock of the carbon is ours up in the atmosphere. We've come up with the same number as at Paris, $100 billion a year. And since Paris, it's been about 75 billion actual, and a lot of that is reclassifying existing aid. Well, just bear in mind that 75 billion per annum is the annual dividend of Saudi Aramco. That shows how serious we are. And on the forestry, same as 2014, again, we're going to try to stop forestry in a decade by a decade's time, not now. And the destruction rate of the Amazon is faster than it's ever been. And 14 billion is part private, part public, and less than we've wasted on an inefficient track and trace system for coronavirus in the UK. These are perspective points. There's a coal pledge, but actually US, China and India are not part of that. There's a methane pledge, but key methane emitters are not part of that frame either. That's not to say these COPs aren't valuable, but where we go from this COP is not to build on its foundations. And what we need to look at quite hard is if we are to pursue a unilateral climate change policy for what is explicitly a global problem, it really doesn't matter where the carbon's emitted. And if we want to get to a position in 2050 where at least we in the UK no longer contribute to climate change, we will not be at that point if we achieve net zero as defined under the Climate Change Act. Quite the contrary, because it's very easy to think of quick ways of reducing territorial carbon emissions in the UK. Just close the rest of the steel industry tomorrow. Why not get rid of the 6 petrochemical plants? Why not hope Brexit finishes off the car industry? This will reduce emissions quite quickly. There'll be big numbers that come from these changes. And we could import the stuff instead. We'd have a huge tick in the box. We'd be the poster country for reducing emissions, as the Prime Minister boasts regularly. But of course, we'd actually, in these particular examples, be increasing global warming because the steel might be produced in a more carbon intensive way in China than it is in the UK. So the only basis on which you can have a unilateral policy towards climate change, which produces the result that we are no longer contributing to climate change, if that is what we want to do, and there are good moral reasons for thinking why we should, is to have a carbon consumption basis. We should treat all our consumption, our carbon footprint, whether domestic or through imports, on the same basis, because it is all carbon to the atmosphere. And the obvious way to do that is a carbon border adjustment. We should also look in within this country to find the cheapest ways of achieving that outcome. And that means applying a carbon price not just to the energy intensive sectors and power, but to the other sectors of the economy, agriculture, transport, and heating in particular. And I note with dismay that the government's effectively ruled out an extension of the UK ETS to these areas for fear of the consequences to consumer bills that might follow from this. Just shows the commitment is skin deep. Bills come first, commitment to climate change comes second. And as we go into a spring in which the energy bill issue and the so-called crisis in the cost of living is going to be at the top of the political agenda, the difference between the rhetoric of all the bold and exciting ambitions and targets and the reality on the ground is stark. And that leads also to the need for an honesty with the population as to what the costs of decarbonisation are. It is fashionable to say it isn't going to cost very much. That's nonsense. But it's even worse. It's fashionable to say, and I actually heard the opposition spokesman on this make this statement, though I've heard it from across the spectrum, that it's worth paying the costs of reducing emissions because the costs of mitigation are much lower than the costs of the damage climate change is going to do. Well, I'm very much in favour of incurring those costs. But anyone who deludes themselves that if the UK achieves net zero, we will not face the costs of global warming doesn't understand that global warming doesn't just happen in London or England, but is a global phenomenon. We are going to get both sets of costs, and we have to prepare the population for those costs. So I would like, after COP26, to cut the rhetoric, to cut the bold speeches and to turn towards a brutal reality about the facts and explain to the population what it means to no longer cause climate change. I'm an inveterate optimist, so I believe the population will see that this is the reality of what's on the table. They must see it already. The estimates for replacing, you know, household gas boilers with heat pumps are not trivial. They're enormous for households, particularly in the lower part of the distribution. These are just the beginning of what it takes to convert an overwhelmingly fossil fuel economy into a low carbon economy going forward. But that's what we must do, and that's what we must take forward. And if we do that, of course, there are great opportunities of pushing this forward. But what we don't want to hear is politicians like Obama, who told the world in his State of the Union speech what a fantastic achievement it was under his presidency to increase fracking in the United States, to dramatically increase gas production and reduce the price to below $2 BTUs, and to massively increase the oil production more than any other president had achieved for decades, and then to preach to the young at Glasgow how important it was for leaders like him to engage in decarbonisation. You know, we can't point in both directions. We need an honesty, and we need to realise that for all the hype around COP26, it is not a sound foundation for taking things forward. This is a very, very serious situation. Climate will warm almost certainly well beyond the 2-degree target. And we have to get real about finding ways of bottom-up incentivizing people to act. And the great advantage of a carbon consumption approach and a carbon border tax is, of course, any country exporting that steel to, say, the UK, when their ship arrives at the docks at, say, Southampton, they can, of course, ask, how can I get out of paying the carbon price? And the answer is, bring us an exemption certificate that shows you paid the carbon price to your own government. It's a no-brainer that exporters of the UK would rather pay their own governments than HM Treasury. And that is the way to pluralize from a coalition of the willing based on carbon consumption, using carbon border adjustments, a bigger and bigger coalition of the imposition of a carbon price more generally around the world. That isn't sufficient, but I think it's necessary. And that's what we should have been talking about in Glasgow, not the hype that we were all possibly a bit seduced by. So there's a pathway to do this. It's not the COP pathway. Good to have George Orr, but let's get on with the reality of really doing what it takes to no longer cause climate change, at least in this country. Thank you.